the unknown can strip us down to the core. That's what it did to me. But that's actually an opportunity for the Lord to enrich our lives, to get rid of some of the junk, to rearrange some things, and then to fill us up with more of himself in some of the places that maybe we weren't willing to let him go before.
Taking a step into the unknown can be scary, and yet when you do so, if you're led by God, it can lead to incredible growth spiritually and great benefits for your life. My guest on this episode is Wendy Zahorjanski. Wendy is a missionary in Serbia, where she lives with her husband, who is Serbian. I first met Wendy and her husband, Danny, back when I lived in Hungary. They were studying at Bible college, and since that time, they've moved to a city in central Serbia called Kragujevac. They have planted a church there. I recently got to visit Wendy and Danny and see their church, and I'm excited for you to hear about God's work in Serbia and in their lives. Wendy recently wrote a book about her experiences stepping into the unknown. Prior to moving to Serbia, she also spent time in Central Asia. So she talks about the important role that taking steps of faith plays in our spiritual growth and our relationship with God. I hope you'll enjoy this conversation. I'll be back at the end with some final words. Well, Wendy, thanks for being a guest today on Theology for the People.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So Wendy, we know each other, but for the sake of our listeners, tell us about yourself and about some of your journey up until this point.
Sure. I grew up in, well, I'm a halfling, so half West Coast, half East Coast. Born in Arizona, but we moved when I was 10 all the way to Vermont. So lived there till I was 19. From a really young age, even before the age of 10, I felt like I was called to be a missionary. And I wanted to live overseas, so that was kind of my dream. Kind of got lost a little bit in high school and tried to do other things, but I couldn't get away from it. Sounds, that's a depressing way of saying it, but the feeling never went away. And so when I was 19, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life or how to get to my goal of being a missionary. And my brother, who was living in Kyrgyzstan at the time, as a missionary, was talking to me, and he said, well, why don't you just move here and figure it out? And I said, why not? I couldn't think of a reason to say no. So I said, why not? And I moved there. And that was my first cross-cultural experience at the age of 19. So I lived with them for 6 months. And that really opened my eyes to not only a different culture, but also talking with people who had no concept of Christianity in general. And so I hung out with a couple Muslim girls at that time. They didn't know what the Bible was. They didn't know who Jesus was even. They weren't, they were more nominal Muslims. So anyway, I'd never been in that situation. And I realized that if I wanted to dedicate my life to this and to talking about this book and to talking about this man, Jesus, that I better know what I'm talking about, first of all, and that I better be sure that I believe it. So that kind of led me to go to Bible college to get more training. And I chose the one in Hungary, Calvary Chapel Bible College, Europe. And I ended up staying there for 3 years. I did the 2-year Bible college program and then the 1-year internship. That's where I met my husband, who is Serbian. And he, as he started sharing his heart to come back to central and southern Serbia, that's kind of when the Lord broke my heart for Serbia as well. It just fit into what I knew that he had called me to as when I was single, and then kind of as we started dating and then we're talking about getting married, his call really fit into mine. So that's really when it ended up happening. We moved to northern Serbia and then we moved our way down, and now we're in central Serbia, and we've been here since 2012, church planting.
Yeah. And what do you think is unique about Serbia? Like, what is unique about ministry in Serbia, and what's the unique setting, and what does church look like, et cetera?
It's a good question. It's probably hard for me to answer because I don't feel like I've had enough experiences with enough different cultures maybe to know what's unique. But what's been different for me from the American context for sure is that it's a much more collective society than individualistic. So even the way that they read the Bible is much more group oriented, I noticed. The way that they view their faith, it's a mix. So some of it's them and God, but a lot of it's their community and God. So something like being well, they would say converting. So Serbian Orthodox is the main religion. So for somebody to come to our church, is a Protestant church, would be considered a change of faith for Orthodox people. So that would be different from my culture that would see those things as probably more similar. And that causes them to be rejected from their social group, which I found in Serbia is a much bigger deal than maybe other places, because it's so, that is so important. And it's so much a part of their identity, their family, and then their like tight knit social group. So to be kind of kicked out of that or to be ostracized is really, really devastating for them. That would be a difference. And they just sit and talk and drink coffee probably more than other cultures that I've been in. They'll just hang out, or if a visitor comes, they'll just spend the whole afternoon with somebody. You know, they just, I don't know, they love hanging out. They love when new people come and when guests come.
Yeah, what struck me when I was there recently with you guys was just that, like, the lack of Protestant representation. And I realize it's a majority Orthodox country, but I've been to a lot of majority Orthodox countries that have like still some Protestant or Bible church type of representation. And it just seemed to be like completely lacking in, you know, south of Belgrade. So like north of Belgrade seems to be a lot of that, but south, it seems like what you guys are doing in your city, which is a pretty large city. And yet I think you guys are like the only Protestant group in town, right?
Yeah, we have. So we live in a city that's 200,000 people. It's the fourth largest in Serbia. And you're right. Once you hit south of Belgrade, then everything stops. It's like an invisible border. And we are, there's one other tiny Protestant group that they don't meet in a home. So it's not a home group, but it's probably, I don't know, 5 or 7 people. And a pastor comes from about an hour away every week or every other week. I'm not really sure. I know he used to come every week. So they meet, they would be a Protestant group. And there was an evangelical church, but the pastor passed away 5 years ago. And I think it was only one family, even when the pastor was still alive. So those would be the other two groups. And then we're the,
Yeah. How much do you think, like, the war that took place in the 90s, like, how much does that affect the way that, like, people are so ingrained in, you know, being Orthodox, and that's a big part of their identity as Serbs?
Yeah, well, which war, first of all? Because there's been so many, but it really is true. That's a good question. And so going back even to when the Ottoman Empire was a reality, up until Belgrade was under the Ottoman Empire for 500 years. But somehow the Serbians maintained their identity in the sense that they maintained the Serbian language and being Orthodox for 500 years under such a cruel, they lost, well, a lot of them were killed because of that. They had to pay really high taxes. There were a lot of things that were discouraging them from taking that route. And just to, it would have been a lot easier to convert, but they didn't. So somehow that's like in them. There's this stubbornness that can be really frustrating, but it's just in, it's, I don't know, that's how they've really maintained their identity. And so I think even the wars after that have kind of almost been a replay of those things. Somebody coming in with some ideology that's different than theirs. World War II, when Nazi Germany came through, you know, the leaders signed to be allies with them and the people revolted because it wasn't what they agreed with. So then you get into the 90s and then you get even into the conflict with Kosovo, and that's a whole thing. But there's a lot of religion thing, Croatia and Serbia too. So it's always mixed, really mixed in. And the Serbians are very fiery. If I could describe them in one word, it would be fiery. And they're really stubborn. So I almost see a turning their back to the West in the sense that they're, that they just want to, they're almost rebellious, like it's this rebellious thing in them. So it definitely affects every level of, even, yeah, especially the wars in the 90s too were kind of a replay of that and them trying to maintain who their national identity, but a lot of times in not a healthy way. So both sides did it, but I see that. And I'm not sure that those wounds have ever been healed. It's something that is very much still real for people, and they don't feel like they were recognized for the things that were done to their nation, and that they have become, in the world's eyes, the terrorists or the bad guys or the ones who led this genocide. But they don't, I know from talking to a lot of them, they don't feel like their side of the story is recognized. Mm-hmm. So I know that also really affects the way they act in the present, that it's almost like they're trying to demand to be heard. And sometimes it can be too forceful for other cultures that don't have that directness.
Yeah. And what do you think, the average Serb who identifies as Orthodox, like, what does their actual faith life look like? I mean, is there a lot of religious practice, or is it more of a nominal thing? What does that look like?
Yeah, I think the average one, no, there wouldn't be a lot of practicing it. One thing that, I don't know, I shouldn't say percent because I don't know, but everybody that I know who's Serbian, so it's a huge percent, is that they all celebrate the celebration of their patron saint. So every family has a patron saint, and the patron saint goes down through the sons. So the son inherits the patron saint of his father. And then there's one day on the calendar for each of these saints, and you have a big celebration, like a huge Thanksgiving dinner, and you invite family and friends over. Everybody does that, and that's tied in to the saint and the church. You go to the church to bless a certain kind of bread that you make for that day. And some people will have the priest come over and do like a blessing on the house for that day. Yeah, that's a big one. A lot of people would probably go for Christmas to church. There's Christmas Eve where they burn an oak branch in the yard of the church. And that's a really big ritual for people that even those who are more nominal would do. And maybe Easter, like mm-hmm. Christmas, Easter, and then that one other patron saint day. But most of them do not. They'll go to church maybe to light a candle to pray for somebody. That would be the common things that I can think of. But praying by themselves, no. Reading their Bible, no. Interacting with a priest, probably not. Mm-hmm. Questioning what their faith means, nope. Mm. Yeah.
And so I know when you guys went into this city, one of the things you first did was you started a Bible club. And I thought that's actually brilliant because it sounds like culturally there's an affinity for the Bible and like a trust in the Bible. So if you can reach them on that level of like, hey, let's read the Bible and let's see what it says. How did that go for you?
Yeah, we did. It was slow. It was so painfully slow. Everything we've done is slow, but it actually was a really good thing, I think, because it made sense to people. We called it, and we had Bible workshops is what we called them. And basically it was just Danny going verse by verse to explain the Bible. And then the end, there would be time for questions that people had. So we didn't do any singing. We didn't do anything else in the beginning. That was it. And it was also because we were coming out of Bible college as theologians. That's what, and so that made sense for people too, that we as theologians would be teaching the Bible. And so we had a few students come. And they had really good questions, and they actually really enjoyed coming, they said, because they could actually talk to Danny was much more approachable than some of their other experiences with clergy within the Orthodox Church. So that encouraged them to come. They liked that the Bible was taught in a way that can be understood. A lot of the liturgies are in like old Serbian mm-hmm. or even the old like Slovenian mm-hmm. language. It's difficult to understand. And if you've ever been in a liturgy, it's like they sing it. Kind of. So it's kind of hard to, in the echoey church, to understand what they're saying, even if it is scripture. So they appreciated that, I remember. And we also had a group of homeless people come for a while and just listen. So it was a mixed bag, but I do think that it was a good way to have a first step in the city.
Mm-hmm. So Wendy, you've written a book called Hard is Only Half the Story. And its subtitle is Real Adventures from My Journey into the Unknown. So obviously this is like your missionary autobiography, and maybe tell us a little bit about like, what is the book about? What is it that you hope that people will get out of it?
Sure. Yeah, the book is, each chapter is a true story from my life in my cross-cultural experience. And what I wanted to do was to show a realistic picture of what it looks like to move into the unknown. So my example of the unknown was a different culture, but it could be for somebody else, maybe a change of job, moving across the country. It doesn't have to be a culture. But I wanted to show just how the unknown can strip us down to the core. That's what it did to me. But that's actually an opportunity for the Lord to enrich our lives, to get rid of some of the junk, to rearrange some things, and then to fill us up with more of himself in some of the places that maybe we weren't willing to let him go before. So that's what, like, in a nutshell it is. And I just wanted to encourage people, first of all, that to take the first step to go into the unknown, but also that that the unknown won't destroy you.
Yeah, so how has your experience on the mission field and stepping into these unknown places, how has that shaped your understanding of God and maybe your relationship with God?
A lot. So in so many ways. I kind of pull also an aspect of that from each of the stories in my book. So one of the stories that I talk about is when my son was born and I had him here in Serbia. And kind of that whole journey really taught me to look back over my life and the paths that the Lord has led me on and find the treasures. That's what I say, and not just to see like the hardness of the path that he's called me on, and to see how he had actually gone before me to remove like some of the things in my way or the obstacles or the logs and make it easier, even though it's not easy. But there are ways that he has gone before me, is what I'm learning and seeing. So that was one thing I would say, that it's taught me to look back just in the way that I call him my path maker in that chapter, that he really is my path maker, that he makes the path before me, and then he walks the path with me, and that he really is, beside me, but also goes before me in the unknown. So that was something. And I think just in general, it's really deepened my trust in him, because I've seen over and over again, no matter what, all these situations that I've been in, or learning a new language or saying stupid things. I mean, you know, because you've learned a language too, that you're put in situations where you feel stupid and you look stupid. And some people are questioning, I think this person really is stupid. They're not sure, because you kind of sound unintelligent in the second language, but that the Lord was faithful no matter what. I was in this whole different context, but the Lord was the same. It was the same God that I had known. Completely different group of people, but somehow like the same truths of who God was were coming through. And so that really deepened my trust in him, that, okay, no matter what, that he's the same. And even though my whole world changed, even though I don't know how to do anything, even though everything's so different, he is the same. And that's really comforting, being in surrounded by new things.
Yeah. You know, the title of your book, it reminded me of a quote that I heard a long time ago from David Livingstone, who was a missionary to Africa. So in 1857, what he would do is, he was a missionary to the interior of Africa. He started out in South Africa, which is where a lot of the missionary work was going on, but a lot of people hadn't explored the interior of Africa. And so he went into the interior and he explored it, mapped it out, but he also preached the gospel and established Christian communities throughout the interior of Africa. But he would often also, he was kind of a celebrity in those days. And so he would go back to England and he would do these tours. And oftentimes they were like university tours. And so he would speak to university students. And so in 1857, David Livingstone spoke to students at Cambridge University. And one of them asked him, like, how did you make such a big sacrifice? Like, how could you sacrifice, you know, so much, you know, your comfort and all of these things to live in that place? And so his famous quote was this. He said, "For my own part, I have never ceased to rejoice that God appointed me to such an office. People talk of the sacrifice I have made in spending so much of my life in Africa. Is that a sacrifice which brings its own blessed reward in healthful activity, the consciousness of doing good, peace of mind, and a bright hope of a glorious destiny hereafter? Away with the word in such a view and with such a thought. It is emphatically no sacrifice. Rather, it is a privilege. Anxiety, sickness, suffering, or danger now and then, with a foregoing of the common conveniences and charities of this life, make us pause and cause the spirit to waver and the soul to sink. But let this only be for a moment. All these are nothing when compared with the glory that shall be revealed in us and for us. I never made a sacrifice." So it's like his famous quote was, you know, I never made a sacrifice, because everybody thought of, you know, what he was doing as such a huge sacrifice. And kind of like reminds me of your title, right? Hard is only half the story. Yes, it's hard, but what God does in you through it and what God is doing through you in it is absolutely transformative for you and for the world. And it's, in the end, I think you would say it's worth it.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I often say that to our church.
Yeah, he said it, yeah.
Yeah, you know, that like if you would ask Paul the Apostle, like, hey, Paul, was it hard, right? Because he talks about how hard it was, especially in 2 Corinthians. He would say, of course it was hard. But that's not really the question, right? Was it worth it? And I think the answer would be emphatically yes. And kind of that's what I got out of your book as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that I'm a much richer person because of having lived here, that I've gained so many things that I could never have, well, maybe never, but that I just didn't have before. And I've learned so many things, and I've been able to adopt things that are ways of thinking that are different than mine that I wouldn't have been exposed to in Vermont, or a different, even a different way of scripture in a group, or some of these things, you know, of worshiping in a different language, singing in a different language. They're just some, each culture really does have something that they're good at, I believe, really good at, and that it carries over into the spiritual world too. And so I just, yeah, it really is a privilege to be able to live here and to be in a different culture so that I can kind of see. Also, when you step out of something, you see some things more clearly. So it's, yeah, amazing to be able to be in that position, to be able to pick up things that are better than the way that I had thought before, and just really rich. I feel so enriched by my experience and by living here.
What do you think are some of the theological implications of this idea of following God into the unknown?
Yeah, when I first started writing the book, the focus was supposed to be a little bit different than it actually ended up being as I was writing. And one of the things that we had talked about, me and my editor, and then when I was brainstorming also with Danny, my husband, was this idea that God in heaven, Jesus in heaven, leaving the heavens and becoming a man on earth was him entering in an unknown, in a sense of being a man. He had never been a man before. And so even in that, when we enter into the unknown, Jesus has gone before us. So we can trust him. We can trust that voice that is either telling us to step out or encouraging us as we're forced into an unknown or a new thing, that we really can trust him because he's done it before us. And he has just that verse that always comes back, that he really, his throne is a place of grace, and it's a place where we find help when we're in need. And all we have to do is come before and ask. So that would be a big one. And then another idea that is also in there is just this idea that when we are, if there's that verse in Isaiah that says that you are my witnesses, says the Lord, and my servant who I have chosen, that you may know and believe me and understand that I am he. And that was also the idea that God doesn't call us in to the unknown or into ministry or into serving him, which we all serve him in some capacity or should be. But we all have the opportunity to serve him in some capacity. That that calling isn't just for us to use. We're not like a tool that he uses and then puts away. That we're actually, when he, whatever he's calling us into, it's also for us to know and believe who he is in a deeper way, in a more broad way, in from a different angle maybe. And that's definitely been true in my life. And I was trying to, through my stories, kind of share that too, that we can, and that also causes deeper trust because he cares about us as a whole person. It's not just to use us. It's not just to further his kingdom in the sense of that we are just like a pawn in his game or whatever, but really he cares about the work that we're doing, but also that what's going on inside. And that's what he wants to transform through, also often uses what we're doing or what we're called to. But those are kind of two big ones then. Yeah.
Yeah. So what would you say to somebody who's not necessarily involved in cross-cultural missions like you are? Maybe it's somebody who says, you know, I'm not sure if I'm called to that. I'm not sure if there's an open door. Maybe I'm, you know, I've got other things that God has placed before me at this time in my life. How can they experience the same kind of transformation and growth in faith in their setting?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think partly everybody needs to sit before the Lord by themselves and ask him, maybe, because he will tell us. If we come before him with a heart that really is open, it's saying, I want to serve you and I want to know what you have for me. What do you have? That he will answer. But I also think that the unknown is all around us. And it's, even if it's not a culture, it's very difficult to enter into. So crossing over into a new friend group is really intimidating. Hanging out with people that maybe aren't our type of people that we necessarily would be our first pick to hang out with, or, you know, going to, going to a block party on your street, but maybe you're not that kind of person. I don't know, you're an introvert, or I don't know. It's a silly example, but all those kind of things can be the unknown. And even if it seems silly, I don't think they are. I think that every step that we take to step into something that's new for us or different can really be enriching. And it really is a great opportunity to learn more about ourselves and more about who God is. So I would also challenge people to look around them and just to maybe see what are some things around them that maybe they might want to step into, or maybe they could step into. What would that look like? What opportunities do they have? You don't have to go somewhere that's far away. You don't need to go on like a short-term missions trip even to have an experience that's like this. It's probably more practical to start right where you are and then kind of to move out and see where the Lord takes you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. So your book is full of kind of these transformative encounters that you had through stepping out into things that were unknown to you. Maybe you could just finish off our talk today by sharing one of those that was particularly relevant to you and how God used it in your life to shape you in a way that was, you know, like you said, heart is only half the story. So
yeah, I'll choose one that was an example of something that I didn't realize I carried inside myself that was really damaging, that I would actually have said was a strength before. So I tell the story of, in one of the chapters, the chapters is called Scribbles. I think we changed the name of that chapter several times, but I think it's Scribbles. Yes, Scribbles. Okay, I just found it. Yeah. And the whole chapter is about really my language learning journey and about how when I moved to Serbia, the reason I wanted to learn the language was to share the gospel. And that was true. And it was my only motive. All I wanted to do was to be able to sit with someone and in Serbian, share the gospel and to talk about spiritual things. But slowly, as the years went by, after, I don't even know how many years, 5 or 6 years probably, and I was getting less, 4 years probably, and getting to the point of being fluent, this weird thing happened with my motive. And all of a sudden, I wanted to be better than all the other foreigners at speaking Serbian. And that became my new goal. And I didn't even realize it. I didn't even realize it until I was sitting with a lady and she looked at me and she said, you know, you speak Serbian better than all the other foreigners that I know. And we knew the same foreigners. And it was like, I did it. I had done what I wanted to do, but all I wanted to do was throw up. It was the worst feeling, because in that moment, I got what I wanted and I realized that it was the worst thing that I could have wanted for. These people were my friends. Several of them were there serving the Lord too and really struggling to learn the language. And here I was like trying to make myself seem better, but I was really pushing them down in the process. And I just realized that I have a tendency to be super competitive. And in the body of Christ, that can be really damaging, that I can slowly twist things to become the better one, to become the smartest person in the room, to even just the tiny bit silly things, walking, carrying water from the garden, from the stream to the garden. And I'm just a little bit ahead of the other lady I'm carrying water with because it's like this, it's so in me that I just need to be first, even if it's by a little bit. But it was in that moment that I realized for the first time how damaging it was and that I wanted to get rid of it and ask the Lord really for help. So I don't always stop like in those times to kind of reflect on what does it mean or what am I learning about myself? But that time I actually did. And I really feel like the Lord freed me. He really freed me from that. And he just brought me back to where I was before, to have the motivation to speak Serbian well so that I could share the gospel. So I kind of see it springing up in other areas of my life. I don't think it's completely dead, that competitive side of me that's not of the Lord, and I'm still working on it. But in that area, it really is dead. It really is a victory. I don't remember the last time I thought about, oh man, I speak so much better than all the other foreigners that I know. So for me, that was a really big deal.
Excellent. Yeah. So, I mean, I love missionary biographies. I know my wife does as well. And so if any of our listeners are looking for a good missionary biography, Wendy, how can people connect with your writing and find your book online?
Yeah. So the easiest way to get my book would be on Amazon. It's on Amazon. So you can just type in Heart is Only Half the Story, or my first and last name, if you can spell it. But it will probably be in the show notes, Wendy Zakuryansky. Yeah. I also have a website, which is my first and last name, WendyZahoryansky.com. Or people can just follow me on Instagram. I'm the only Wendy Zahoryansky. So they should be able to find me.
That's nice.
And that would be a good way just, it is nice. So those are probably the main ways. For the book, Amazon, if you want to follow me and kind of more about my writing journey, Instagram would be the best place.
Awesome. Hey, Wendy, thanks so much for your time and for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Theology for the People. New episodes are released every Wednesday, so make sure to subscribe to the podcast on whatever app you use. In the next episode, I'll be speaking with my friend and colleague, Mike Neglia, about how journaling can be a spiritual discipline. We also talk about the role of spiritual disciplines in general and how to intentionally take steps that lead to growth and good fruit in your life and in your relationship with God. Theology for the People is a listener-supported program. If you have enjoyed or been encouraged by this content, please consider sharing it with others and leaving a review on either Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you'd like to support this podcast financially, there's a link in the show notes where you can make a donation to support the show. Until next time, thanks for listening, and God bless you.